is an indication that marijuana was not recently consumed by Mr. Zavala.
Do we know what we mean by recently?
I believe the testimony was within a few hours, possibly a couple of days, but I believe it was within a few hours. The inactive metabolite can stay in someone's bloodstream for days, if not weeks. I believe there was information to that point.
Thank you.
So from this circumstantial evidence, the trial court found that there was no evidence that the jury could infer that anyone had smoked marijuana that night. Clearly, the jury can infer from any one, if not all, of these points of circumstantial evidence that someone had smoked marijuana that night. And the fact that Michelle Cavazzi brought it with her, clearly they can infer that she was possibly one of them. So after having shown what would have affected her perception and recollection, Mr. Zavala sought to show how that would have affected her perception and recollection of what happened that night. And to do that, he called Sarah Erfurt, a forensic toxicologist from Chemitox Laboratory in Boulder. It was during the beginning examination on this point that the state stipulated to her qualifications as an expert in forensic toxicology that this state raised its relevance objection, and the court found that there was no evidence that anyone had smoked marijuana that night. Defense counsel made a detailed offer of proof talking about what she would have testified to and the effects of marijuana on the human body and how someone behaves. The offer of proof included the statement that chronic marijuana users would have trouble forming memories and reciting facts and circumstances and sequences of events in a meaningful, coherent, accurate, precise fashion. This explained why she couldn't remember what happened and why she was giving varying accounts of what happened.
What was the defendant's theory of the case, if he had one?
You know, I believe it was in large part simply a reasonable doubt defense, that we don't know, based on Ms. Jacobazzi's conflicting and varying statements to the officers that day and comparing those statements to what she testified to, the state hasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt that what happened in that apartment was second-degree kidnapping.
So this only applies to the kidnapping charge?
Your Honor, it applies primarily to the kidnapping charge. There's a separate issue about the felony menacing charge, which I raised in my opening brief, but this primarily goes to the kidnapping charge. Other charges, Mr. Zavala essentially confessed by the way of his defense, and the attempted first-degree murder charge he was acquitted on.
So did the defendant argue, or his counsel argue in closing, that these events just didn't occur? Or what did they argue?
The argument was essentially that the jury could not rely on the testimony and the statements of Ms. Jacobazzi. Her statements to law enforcement were contradictory on the same point. Her statements varied from what she told law enforcement to what she testified to at trial. She just simply was not a reliable source of information upon which they could base their verdict of second-degree kidnapping.
Mr. Lacefield, going back to what the proffer about what the expert would have testified to, the proffer mentioned the effects of so-called chronic use. Was there an offer of proof about what that meant? What did the expert believe to be chronic use, and did that bear any resemblance to the victim's testimony that she occasionally smoked marijuana with the defendant?
I don't believe that there was a specific description of what chronic use meant beyond simply the everyday definition of regular or extended use of marijuana.
Okay.
So no, I don't believe it was specifically defined as to this is what I mean by chronic, whether it's, you know, this many times or over this course of time.
But was that offer of proof suggesting or arguing that the victim was a chronic user of marijuana? Was that the defense theory for that evidence?
The offer of proof was that a chronic marijuana user would have trouble forming coherent thoughts and perception of what was happening based on the chronic use of her time, and then possibly also due to or amplified by the use on the day in question and the impairment as a result of the use that day.
But why would that be relevant unless the defense also alleged that she was a chronic user?
Well, that was part of the allegation. It was both that she had used over time. There was evidence about the relationship that she and Mr. Zavala had together was one of sex and drinking and drugs, with both of them involved in the cocaine and marijuana use.
Did the trial court preclude cross-examination on her use of marijuana?
No, there was examination on her use of marijuana. And that's where she equivocates and is asked, or she testifies, quote, not that I remember, when she was asked if she was high when she went to Mr. Zavala's. There's questioning about if she smoked marijuana at her sister's, if she smoked marijuana at Mr. Zavala's, and she denies smoking marijuana at Mr. Zavala's, but says she can't remember if she was high when she got there.
But what could the predicate have been of an expert's opinion that she was a chronic user of marijuana?
The relationship, well, the activities that she engaged in with Mr. Zavala and their relationship. There was testimony to the fact that their relationship was casual and consisted of marijuana and cocaine use. They had a relationship of approximately, I think, 2 to 3 months prior to the, well, I believe it was June or July through October.
But did the expert have any reason to know how often she used marijuana?
I don't know that there is reference in the transcripts that the expert had reviewed discovery, but beyond that, I don't know that the record indicates one way or another.
I mean, without that, how could the testimony of the expert been useful to the jury unless the expert had a factual basis to know how much allegedly the witness or the victim smoked marijuana?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that there are blind experts that are offered every day in trial to testify to the characteristics of how a victim might respond to a sexual assault, for example. And those experts are allowed to testify regardless of whether they're basing that information on anything specific to that case. So I think this would be comparable in that respect. And it would be up to the jury to decide whether the evidence that they had received was sufficient to consider Ms. Iacovazzi's use, historical and that day, sufficient enough to believe that it would have, you know, given rose to the level of a chronic user as being described by Ms. Erfer.
Mr. Lacefield, I know that you're asking for reversal in this case. So even if, say, that an inference were enough to have an expert come in and testify about the marijuana use, what is it that was not allowed into evidence that would have made a difference given that the jury heard that her statements were inconsistent?
An explanation about why they were inconsistent. Here, the prosecution was able to give its explanation of a startling or scary event and the passage of time as explaining why the jury should not put as much weight in her recent inability to recall and the varying statements that she gave to officers later on. If the jury were given the explanation that the defense was offering here, and this is the defense to the second-degree kidnapping charge, make no mistake about it, then the jury might understand the first statement and the second and the third and the fourth as all being the result of her faulty perception and recollection as a result of having consumed marijuana. Does that answer the court's question?
So what you're saying is it's not just the mere inconsistencies, but it's a faulty perception underlying any of the statements.
It would be an explanation to the jury about here's why you cannot rely on any of the statements, why none of them are reliable. It's not just that the first one is reliable and the second and third and fourth are not. It's that they're all unreliable because of this marijuana use and its impact on her ability to perceive and recall what happened.
Are you going to address the menacing conviction?
I would be happy to do that, Your Honor. The menacing conviction, the state seems to base this conviction on the fact that there is one piece of evidence to support this, and that is not the substantial and sufficient evidence test. The one piece of evidence that they have is Mr. Zavala's conclusory statement, as recalled by Deputy Waller, that he used the knives to threaten the women. Use under the felony menacing statute requires more than mere access. It requires, under People v. Adams, possession or on the defendant's person. There's no evidence here, well, beyond that conclusory statement from Mr. Zavala, which he made when his BAC was at a .25. When you look at Ms. Miller's testimony, she says he didn't pick any of them up. Even Ms. Iacovazzi testified that she didn't remember Mr. Zavala ever picking any of those knives up.
Or aren't you asking us to weigh the evidence? I mean, what's confusing, assuming it was said and assuming the jury accepted it, what's confusing about the defendant said, I used, the word you used, I used a knife to threaten the victim? What's confusing about that? Why doesn't that in and of itself viewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution, support the conviction?
The jury asked a question during deliberations, which I think gets to the heart of why or how this was confusing. They asked a question along the lines of, can inferring or referring to the items be considered use? This isn't a separate error, but I think it does go to show that the jury was not clear on what constituted use, whether he was saying that I used them by their presence in the apartment, or did he mean I used them as in I held them? It's not at all clear that this is what Mr. Zavala meant. And when you take that and consider it in combination with the rest of the evidence, which is what the court has to do when applying the substantial and sufficient evidence test, we don't have that here. If I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jacob Loughran, registration number 40904, and I represent the people in this matter. The people respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's judgment of conviction for two reasons. First, the district court properly barred the expert testimony regarding the use and consumption of marijuana and its effect on a witness's recall and recollection. The court also there was also sufficient evidence to sustain the defendant's conviction for felony menacing as to J.M. As to the first issue, the court did properly bar the expert testimony regarding the consumption of marijuana and its effect on a witness's recollection and recall, despite the fact that relevant evidence is generally admissible. In this case, that evidence wasn't relevant. And even if it were relevant, trial courts are vested with broad discretion to determine whether an expert's testimony should be allowed in a given case, and it should only be overturned if that the trial court's decision was manifestly erroneous. That level of deference is generally given by this court to the district court under the understanding that the district court has a superior opportunity to judge the expert's competence and to determine whether the testimony would be helpful to the fact finder.
But Mr. Loughran, sorry to interrupt you. What was the trial court's basis for excluding the expert's testimony about the effect of marijuana?
In this case, the primary reason for excluding it was that it was not relevant to any issue at trial because there was no evidence of marijuana use on the night in question.
You say the primary reason. Was there another reason?
There was also some overtures to the fact that there might not have been full disclosure of this particular expert testimony prior to trial, but the court didn't base its ruling on that. And that was mostly discussions between counsel several days prior to this actual ruling.
But that wouldn't justify the exclusion of the evidence based upon a theory that there was an historical use of marijuana, irrespective of whether it was used that night, would it?
Well, I think there's two separate issues there, and the court is correctly identifying them. My response to that would be there was absolutely no evidence of chronic use by the witness in this case. All she testified to was that she had previously used marijuana on other occasions with the defendant. She didn't say every day, she didn't say every week, she didn't say every month. There's no indication as to how often that was.
So what do you think chronic means then? Apparently you think it has a very clear and defined meaning.
No, I'm not saying that at all, Your Honor. And in fact, perhaps it would have been helpful if there would have been any proffer as to what the expert would say on that point, and there wasn't in this case.
So how do we know that her discussion of her multiple use in the past didn't constitute as chronic use?
Well, I guess my response to that, Your Honor, would be there was no discussion of how often it occurred. And I think that's the point I'm trying to make, is it can't be, there was nothing to establish chronic use if we don't know how often the use occurred. It could have been 2 times prior, it could have been 20 times prior. That question was never asked by defense counsel below, and certainly not sufficiently to establish some level of chronic use, especially without any indication that the expert would say 2 times is enough, 5 times is enough, 10 times is enough.
What was the proffer as to what the expert would have testified if permitted to do so?
I think defense counsel accurately portrayed what the proffer was, and that's essentially she would have testified that the use of marijuana on a particular occasion or chronically can have an impact on a witness's recollection and perception. And as it related to this particular case, and as the district court found, there was no evidence that LY or any other person used drugs on the night of the incident. Elle White herself expressly stated, despite what defense counsel has said, that she said, I don't remember. She said that one time. There was a string of questions there where she repeatedly said, no, I did not use that night. No, I did not use drugs with the defendant that night. That's also consistent with the officer's later testimony that L.Y. did not appear to be impaired or intoxicated. J.M., the other victim, testified no one used drugs while she was there. She did not observe any drug use. And in fact, when the defendant asked L.Y. to provide him with the drugs, L.Y. said, no, we're not going to do that right now in your frame of mind. Nothing in L.Y.'s sister's testimony at trial suggested that L.Y. had used drugs at her house prior to going to the defendant's. The record is replete with any indication that L.Y. used drugs on the night of the incident or at any time in the immediate period preceding her going to the defendant's home.
Well, Mr. Lofgren, let me ask you, there were witnesses denying marijuana use, and there was also evidence of marijuana apparently being used, and so there was conflicting evidence. So when you're saying no evidence, I mean, what can we look at? Are we limited to the denials, or?
I don't believe it was conflicting evidence. There was evidence of drug paraphernalia within the defendant's apartment. I think that's important to recognize. This is the defendant's apartment where there was a pipe that had residue and some other marijuana paraphernalia throughout the apartment. Nothing indicated that any of that paraphernalia had been used that night or the day before that, just simply that it was there and it had been used at some point in the history of the defendants.
Okay, so understanding your position of the record then, there was just no evidence at all, circumstantial or direct, of any marijuana use?
If it was circumstantial, it was very weak circumstantial evidence, and to get to the point that evidence would have supported the expert's testimony, the jury would have had to reject L.Y.'s trial testimony, reject the testimony of the other witnesses who said there was no drug use that night, and then stack the inference that the presence of paraphernalia and an admission of prior use, whenever that was, somehow indicated that L.Y. and the defendant had smoked on this night. That's simply an untenable position to suggest that the jury would reject direct testimony and accept inference upon inference upon inference to suggest that someone had used that night.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Lawson, you said that the other victim also testified that there was no marijuana use that night?
She did. And that's at page 54, lines 13 through 20. She says the defendant asked L.Y. to provide him with the drugs, and L.Y. said, no, we're not going to use drugs because of the frame of mind you're in. She was concerned.
But she got there after Lisa was already there. So how did she know what happened before she got there?
This is true, and she didn't testify as to what happened before she got there. My recollection of the record is that Lisa was only there for a very, very brief period of time before the other victim arrived.
All right, thank you.
And there's nothing to suggest drugs were used during that time.
Do you agree with the analogy that counsel attempts to draw between the proffered expert testimony here and testimony in sex assault cases where you have a psychologist come in and talk about typical reactions that a victim to such a crime would have?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree, because in that situation, a blind expert is testifying where there's other evidence presented that a sex assault has occurred. So the blind expert is testifying based on the other evidence that's already been provided at trial that a sex assault occurred. Here, this isn't a blind expert, and this expert wouldn't have been testifying as to something that evidence already supported occurred. There's no evidence of drug use that night. This isn't blind expert testimony to support that non-existent evidence. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
As to the second issue, the felony menacing conviction, the people agree that more than access has to be presented to support use. But in this case, there was testimony from an officer who arrested the defendant that after he arrested the defendant confessed, I used these knives to threaten the victims, including JM. The defendant's confession was enough here, and certainly enough that the jury, as the fact finder, could balance all of the evidence, weigh the witness credibility, and determine, as the fact finder, whether the defendant was guilty of this crime.
But Mr. Lofgren, there was any evidence about what the defendant meant by the term use? I mean, that's a pretty vague term. It's pretty general. We don't know what he meant by that, by using it. You admit that it's a limit to satisfy the statute. It's a limited definition of physically possessing or holding the weapon, not just having access to it. Use can mean having access to it. It could mean more. So it's sort of ambiguous what he meant by use, I think. But given that point, when we have both victims saying that he did not hold the weapon or possess a weapon while they were there, or at least while Julie was there, doesn't that give necessary and unrebutted context to what the defendant meant by the word use? I mean, why would he say he used a weapon when the victim said he didn't use the weapon, in a sense that we need to, a sense of the statute?
There's two responses I would have to that. The first is that if there was any ambiguity in what the defendant was saying, that's for the jury to decide whether he meant he used it in the sense that's necessary for the statute or whether he meant he had mere access. The second response I would have is the jury was there and present to witness the witness testimony. And even reading the witness testimony, you can tell both of these victims were sort of restraining their version of what happened that night because they both cared very much for the defendant. It's evident in the record that they didn't ever imagine that this was going to cause the defendant to go to prison, his actions that night. The jury could observe what those witnesses were saying, how they were saying it, their demeanor when they were saying it, and could compare that to the defendant's confession on the night of the incident and the statements that the victims made to the police on the night of the incident that were a lot more firm than their testimony at trial.
But Lisa didn't have any problem saying he used a knife to threaten me and to say he was going to kill me. She said that at trial. So why would she have some incentive to not admit that he also used a knife with respect to the other victim?
It's hard to say, but and again, it all comes down to that should be a jury determination. They heard all of this evidence, the defendant's confession versus the testimony of both Lisa and the other victim, JM, at trial. The jury's role is to determine whether they believe the victim's testimony at trial or the confession the defendant made to the officer. And this court shouldn't simply overturn that because they have a different take on the evidence.
Do you agree that all of the evidence, save the confession or alleged confession by the defendant, would establish that there was no use of the knife?
I would not say that. I would say the evidence of the defendant's confession is the strongest support for the use of a knife, but there's also many references in the record to the abundance of knives throughout the apartment, in the bedroom, in the kitchen.
But that's not enough. That's not enough to prove felony menacing.
I agree.
He has to use it. Is there any other evidence in the record other than the defendant's supposed confession that he used the knife in threatening that victim?
That he actually picked a knife up and
yes.
pointed it at JM? No, there's no evidence that's that firm, but I believe the access, when coupled with the defendant's confession, would be circumstantially enough for the jury to conclude that he menaced JM. If there are no further questions, I would respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's judgment of conviction. Thank you.
To say that the evidence is irrelevant about whether Ms. Giacovazzi's perception and recollection was impacted by her consumption of marijuana, to say that that is irrelevant is to say that her testimony is irrelevant, and that is all the state has to support the second-degree kidnapping charge. There was only a relevance objection that was made when this testimony was offered. There was no other objection that the state made or that the court based its ruling on when it came to Ms. Erfer's testimony about the use of marijuana that night and whether or not there was any evidence of marijuana and why it was precluding her testimony. The court didn't find that there was no evidence of chronic use. The court found that there was no evidence of use whatsoever. Ms. Giacovazzi admitted smoking marijuana and using cocaine with Mr. Zavala during their relationship. She came over in response to a text message asking her to bring some bud and wine. She actually did bring marijuana with her to Mr. Zavala's apartment, and there was a marijuana pipe with burnt marijuana residue found in the apartment. And this isn't just paraphernalia, Your Honor. There was in addition to the pipe with burnt marijuana residue, there is the bud that was found where she said that she was sitting in the bedroom on the bed. And there was evidence of a marijuana implement known as a marijuana vaporizer, which was plugged in and turned on, and that also would have been Ms. Erfer's testimony. So this is far beyond simple paraphernalia. The state makes arguments that go to weight. to really go to weight, not admissibility. Here, the jury did not receive this important evidence, and I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Zavala's second-degree kidnapping conviction. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. The case is submitted, and we will issue a written opinion to decide the case. One